Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tom Castura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. Let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for June 30th, 2025. So, Tom, what do you got for us to kick everything off?
All right, starting this week, got an article from Arctic Wolf Labs. It's titled, Gifted Crooks Strategic Pivot from Browser Stealer to Data Exfiltration Platform During Critical Ukraine Negotiations. So, general overview here, Arctic Labs discovered that a cyber espionage group, UAC-0226, known for utilizing the InfoStealer Gifted Crook, has significantly evolved its capabilities, transitioning the malware from basic browser data stealer into and through two new upgrades, moving to a bit more of a robust intelligence gathering tool. And their campaigns have continuously coincided with the Ukraine-Russia peace talks early this month, actually. Well, the previous month, now it's July, so the early June 2025. So they're a typical version of their original stealer, you know, was mostly looked at browser credential theft, and then they would zip up that data and send it out via Telegram bots. But their upgrades that have been seen between May and June of this year, the first upgrade added file theft capabilities, kind of targeting docs by certain extensions. The target files would typically be 5 megabytes or less and would be looked for that were created within the last 15 days. And then they also introduced XOR string encryption and AES encrypted zip archives into this new evolution of the tool. And then more recently, they've continued to add on to the browser and document theft with additional browser types added and other functionalities. And they go after different things beyond just the credentials. They upped their time frame for recent files from 15 days to 45 days, and then added in additional sandboxing techniques, like some sleep techniques to kind of avoid that sandboxing detection. So kind of how this the infection vector and targeting happened. So spear phishing emails would be military-themed PDF lures that would spoof multiple Ukrainian regions. And then the PDF prompts users to enable macros to view the document, something we haven't talked about or seen in a little bit. But that would lead to the malware droppers. And then the executables specifically would seek the files inside of those timeframes. And then the presence of various file types, including document, OpenVPN configuration files, and other unfamiliar extensions, highly suggest that the threat actor, they possess intimate knowledge of the victim infrastructure that they're targeting. That familiarity likely extends to the internal file storage system, even encompassing files with proprietary or undisclosed extensions for Arctic Labs. So the Gifted Crook implant creates a dedicated directory for files it finds that match its search parameters. And it then copies these files into this new directory, organizing them into subdirectories that mirror their original system location. And then they would drop these under the app data local temp area. And the exfiltration, again, done through the Telegram bot channels with long-lived bot tokens that were established, and they would be leveraging API calls out to Telegram. So something that was noted is there was a email infrastructure overlap with other phishing campaigns. Some of those campaigns that were deploying the net support rat, basically kind of implying that there's multiple groups targeting Ukraine, which is not something that's necessarily novel. Certainly opportunity to hunt for this kind of activity, specifically off the top, looking for suspicious files within that app data local temp area. Another area to track, this is one that we've been seeing and kind of touched on pretty regularly, is that that API calls out to things like Telegram. With tools like Telegram, Discord, and others that we've talked about being continuously leveraged as a C2 contact point, being suspicious or at least aware of your environment and the communications it's having through these API calls, I think would be super beneficial. Great place to start poking. But beyond that, Scott, as I have echoed and complained about before with ClickFix and it being, you know, trying to really get my brain around how effective it is, here we kind of see that old school method of, you know, working and tricking the users into enabling macros. I don't think we've talked about that in a while, and that's something that's been as old as time, right? I mean, we've been dealing with that battle for a long time, just haven't really talked about it much. So it was a little surprising to kind of see the effectiveness of that still happening. But I guess these things continue to manage to trick users and allow attackers to get in. But yeah, what did you think of all this?
Yeah, so The switch to using macros, where they're doing, where, you know, you're obviously going to prompt the user to somehow enable macros so then you can get your payload delivered. There might be a reason behind that based on like some of the geopolitical, where there's like peace talks happening and other things going on. And so there's not the same time frame to like, let's stand up some infrastructure that where they could do like a click fix or some other type of meme, because you could just basically send your weaponized file via email, which is kind of an easier delivery. And you also have good topics in order to theme the email on to, you know, get more vested interests. So that might be part of the reason there. I always try to think about that just to, you know, possibly understand, you know, some of those types of motivations for those decisions. I do like the, you know, when you mentioned writing things in the app data local temp directory, you know, there's a couple things there that I thought would be worth calling out. And that is, obviously they're writing multiple things. Maybe it's worth looking at not just things written, but if you can, you can put some guardrails up on like, if so many files are written within a time window, that might help you identify more suspicious behavior than just any write. Depending on what you want to focus on, right? If you really want to narrow in like data being gathered potentially. Other thing I was kind of thinking about, obviously looking at the API calls to Telegram, that's something I feel like you should be able to have the visibility in your environment to know that kind of activity is happening, depending on whatever tool offers it. But when they were talking about the like 5 megabyte file size type stuff with the files they were creating that they were going to archive or send out, I was wondering if that was like an API limitation too. So like how they would gather data was dependent on how they can exfil the data. I don't know enough about the API with Telegram and the send document call, what that entails. But sometimes it's also worth, like, if there is a common tool or service that's being leveraged by adversaries, it's kind of good to do the research to dig in. I haven't done it here, but, you know, what other API calls can you do a Telegram, for instance? Are there any other ways to either do some tricky things for either social engineering, potentially ways to get credentials from people and leveraging some sort of API calls to get that sent or whatever? Or, you know, obviously actual data in this case. So there's always good things to spend time researching so that you might be able to get ahead of some attacks, because obviously an adversary has done their research if they're using a service. So they're probably more acquainted with it than a lot of the defenders are. So it's a good place to kind of play catch up so that you're kind of playing on the same chessboard in terms of those things. And then the time window thing I thought was interesting. Because obviously, if you're looking for the last 15 days on previous campaigns and you're opening that up, either, you know, that always is an interesting decision, because I imagine the get in, get out approach and what's most relevant probably is the more recent stuff. But depending on the purpose for getting in and getting out, or just maybe having campaigns that didn't really get them much, they may decide to open that up. But another interesting thing. But yeah, it's always interesting to see some of the techniques that, are still being kind of leveraged. You know, it's not like anything is net new here, other than I haven't heard of this information stealer name, only because I haven't been specifically looking for net new information stealers. I usually come across them this way anyways. But as far as the techniques go, yeah, I'm not, I guess not surprised with anything they've done here.
You know, something that I left with as a thought after kind of looking at this, and you get these abstract thoughts once in a while when you're kind of reading through intel and you're thinking about how would I protect my environment? What would I consider that's not necessarily, you know, standard? But when you're looking at these targeted attacks and how we've seen them before, where they talk about the various areas that they used that showed that it was kind of really organizationally targeted, right? And they knew more about their infrastructure. When you have things like this where you're leveraging these kind of abstract file extensions for X, Y, or Z, you know, it's probably some kind of level of program or whatever your process is in your environment. I wonder how many defenders are considering that. You know what I mean? So it was something, you know, not necessarily a takeaway per se, but a thought that I had that was pretty interesting. Like, how would I go about considering that in my environment? These are things that are abstract and different. if they're targeted or leveraged in a given way, would I be able to use that as some kind of a trip line to say, hey, maybe somebody's looking at getting something very specific to us? You know, random thought to close this one up.
No, I mean, that's why it's always good to think like an attacker, because, you know, attackers could do things so many different ways and defenders could do things so many ways. And if we just stay in our own bubble, the things we think about doing as from a defender might not overlap effectively. You know, you get that Venn diagram where the overlap is incredibly small or just non-existent. So, you know, you've really got to tackle the challenge from the attacker's perspective. I mean, it's kind of like doing like, you know, if you've got vermin in your house or something and you use the wrong poison or use traps to catch something totally different, you're not really solving the problem, even though you're potentially preventing a future problem or a problem you could have in the future, but that's not always your purpose, right? So stuff like that.
All right, what do you got next for, Scott?
Yeah, so I'm going to jump into a meaty one, only because there was a recent publication of a DFIR report. So we've talked about DFIR reports in the past. Or if you're new to cybersecurity or defense, understanding, analyzing things, they're really good reports because they do cover down on a lot of things. You can learn a lot from them because a lot of the stuff they cover in great detail is stuff that you see as parts of other attacks that don't get publicly covered. But it's titled Hide Your RDP Password Spray Leads to Ransom Hub Deployment. So it was interesting. I'll kind of crawl through some of this stuff, but basically what they were seeing is there was a IP that was had been reported by a number of people doing basically scanning, failed to attempt trying to connect the firewall, brute forcing type activity. And so it's been coming up for, I think it was almost like, 4 months or so ago, doing this type of activity. And I guess eventually got, you know, successfully logged in where there was RDP exposed. So knowing where you have things like that exposed and being aware when that potentially could be exposed is good to know. And so, yeah, you can, you know, see from a successful login accounts, RDP. It looks like the workstation itself even had RDP in the host name. You know, interestingly enough, maybe even if you do some enumeration that way, you might find out that's there. So one of the things they did from an execution perspective, they did drop like a VBS script as well as an R clone executable. That was kind of how they exfilled things. And to run R clone, they use a bat file to basically manage that whole process. They use numerous PowerShell commands we've seen. So in this case, it looked like if they were targeting VMs specifically that were running, they use PowerShell command to shut down VMs. Obviously, that's going to be part of the encryption process for the ransomware. And then also they were using PowerShell to also remove instances of the shadow copy. So some people have used VSS admin and things like that, pretty common internal tools, but we have seen PowerShell in the past too. In this case, they're using PowerShell. They talk about, you know, a bunch of different things and a lot of different layers, but two things that we see commonly from a persistence perspective, they did do deploying Atera and Splashtop remote management tools, which this is kind of the go-to thing when you see ransomware operators, easy off-the-shelf stuff that's not going to flag typically. That gives them kind of that persistence, but also that level of access that's similar to RDP. they also used FSUtil that allowed remote to local symbolic links. This is interesting because I haven't really seen this specific technique, and I didn't dig into it specifically, but what I'm assuming is things they call locally will work when they're connected to remote machines as well, so they don't have to like figure out any of their coding or commands. Is my guess. I haven't played with that, but it's something to look into because I think it's unique enough because I haven't seen it to understand what they're trying to achieve there. And obviously they're doing some clearing of logs like you would see using WebUtil or WEventUtil. So, you know, that part was interesting. There was a log that I've never looked for, and I thought it was actually worth collecting. I don't know how noisy it is, but they use credentials file view, which is it might be a Nearsoft tool, if I remember correctly. But either way, it's a tool you can download that allows you to view the credentials file. And I think it looks at the credential manager on a Windows system. And there's a event that's 5379. And it will alert when there's credentials trying to be enumerated from there. I'm guessing when applications need to go there to fetch credentials, they probably maybe kick off a similar log. So that's where it could be noisy, especially with like single sign-on stuff. But they have the enumerate credentials, which obviously is going to be reading, I'm assuming, the whole database stored there, or there's just re-credentials. So I'm assuming there's going to be a difference. So that's something that you could pay attention to potentially that I thought was uniquely different. Then they, you know, did kind of the similar thing with the LSA dumps using Nimikatz to try to pull down the credentials out of Active Directory. Nothing uncommon there. They also use Advanced IP Scanner. I've talked about that before, which is, and they use SoftPerfect NetScan. So two different types of scanning tools. Advanced IP Scanner is really good at finding shares. SoftPerfect is good at finding services and stuff as well. The interesting thing about Advanced IP Scanner is if it does find shares and they are testing the right capability, which in this case they did enable that option, it does create a delete me on those shares to validate the tool's validating. It can write to those. And that's how it tests for it. So there's a lot of that. The amount of Windows discovery commands being leveraged in this with the net command, NL test to look at domain trust, IP config to look at, you know, the configurations, IP information in the local subnets. So they had a lot of that going on. And trying to think what other interesting other artifacts they had going on here. But yeah, I mean, they use a lot of RDP when they could. They use SMB to kind of move things. They use SMB to basically move their ransomware that was able to be seen. And the ransomware, when it was being dropped on different machines, was just a random named EXE based on what it looked like. So that was something, you know, to kind of pay attention to, you know, weird executables being dropped. If you even pay attention to those writes and then you start seeing increased writes across multiple systems, especially, that would be, you know, hugely indicative. But yeah, I mean, it's just like your standard kind of breach, starting from RDP access, using some of the common tools and techniques that we see in a lot of breaches. So stuff that we either commonly look for or should be thinking about how to look for in a lot of cases. And yes, but then great detail as far as like the timeline, artifacts. So it's a good report to put your eyes on in general. But yeah, I just wanted to kind of hit some of the high points, cover some of the things we always talk about to say they're still relevant. And to basically highlight a really good report to look at to understand attack flow and how things lead to the next step across that, you know, life cycle chain. So what do you think? I know there's a lot there.
There's a lot there. That's not a bad thing. Honestly, it's put together really nice. If we were to say, because we talk about this kind of routinely, if we were to say, okay, there's these typical frameworks that tend to follow as far as an attack chain is concerned, that is pretty common as far as the from initial access through execution to exfil, the whole nine, right? This one wraps it up pretty good, man. It summarizes the playbook pretty good, and it's broken down with a lot of detail. The DFIR reports are always excellent. But one of the things that I picked out that was a little newer that we don't necessarily see often, well, at least maybe me, maybe I just don't see this often. I'm curious what, if you have, Scott, but the leveraging by the threat actor of the Microsoft Management Console snap-ins. So it looks like they leveraged four distinct ones, the DNSManagement.msc, which would allow them to browse and manipulate DNS server configurations. The domain.msc, which, you know, view and manage domain, forest, and trust configurations. The DSSiteMSC, which view and manage replication, site topology, and subnet associations within Active Directory. And then the DSAMSC, which is used to manage groups, users, computers, things like that. So they were playing with some of the snap-ins. I thought that was kind of a little bit of a newer flag beyond things that we typically talk about. My brain started going on, you know, maybe this is something we'd want to be making sure we're considering or looking for, because that's, I would think, especially in bulk, like, you know, where you see this activity shown in this report, where you see all of these hit in the relative time, I have to imagine that's uncommon. You're not typically going to see that. If so, you should be able to mark it off as actual activity relatively fast, right? But yeah, there's a lot here. Definitely a great report to read, whether you're advanced or, you know, just kind of in the field. Love the DFIR reports, so much detail top down, but I think it does a great job of encompassing the very common framework we're seeing right now in 2025 as far as typical attacks are concerned.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, like the snap and stuff, I did see that, and my only guess is why they were potentially leveraging that was because they probably already compromised credentials pretty quick. They gave them some high level of access, so maybe looking at how they want to spread the ransomware or potentially move files easier, you know, via, like, could they, you know, potentially do group policy? How are things trusted? Would this, you know, bleed over to something else? I don't know. That could be some of that. Obviously, when you have RDP access, typically most users aren't given that across the board. So when someone leaves RDP open to the outside and someone's able to get in, I'm going under the assumption that there is some elevated access just even with that initial connection, which really helps them, or at least speeds them along as far as their attack life cycle.
Yeah, and I'm going to say something that's probably typical knowledge, but maybe some folks aren't thinking about it. So in the report, they do talk about, like, leveraging a NetScan tool on the exploited workstation, so that OpenRDP device. And they show that they're, you know, the NetScan tool had some top scan ports, and those, you know, within those top scan ports, you know, you have your SMBs and your RDPs, right? And you see the how many unique destinations are open there. And if you're not aware of that in your environment, definitely something to consider. It's one thing to have a rogue device that's exposed to the internet, which I think any one of us in the security industry has come across that or is aware of that when it happens sometimes. It's another thing too, when you're able to very easily pivot within your environment, because once they splash down, that's just it makes it so easy, right? So knowing what's going on in your environment there, I think it's of value, right, Scott?
Yeah. And, you know, something we don't talk about often, you know, we talk about being proactive because we're threat hunters. So we think, like, going and looking for behaviors and things like that are good. Scanning is also a good thing. And there's a conflict that comes up there, right? Because they'll be like, oh, well, we can't just openly just scan our environment because that could have performance impact and things like that. And not every scanner is created equal, and some scanners can be more aggressive. And if you're looking for vulnerabilities, those can be really aggressive. So, you know, a lot of times I like to think of, there's network scanning for looking for open ports. That shouldn't shut down a network, right? And if that is a concern, that should just be documented as a vulnerability in that case, if that's really the concern. And then it needs to be managed in some way. Because network scanning can be really noisy, but, you know, especially if it's targeted, relatively light. And then even from the vulnerability perspectives, a lot of times, unless they're, like, the vulnerability scanning is, like, risky, like, sometimes looking for vulnerabilities can inadvertently crash something. But a lot of times, if they've been published and they're being, the scans being utilized in a lot of the main products, they've been tested enough to where they likely aren't, or they'll give you that warning. But also, if you're looking for an individual vulnerability, not as impactful than saying, give me every single vulnerability on a machine. So also to take that into consideration, if you're going to proactively be looking for things, it's always good to have the conversation to let people know that, hey, I plan on looking for these things so that everyone's aware. But if you get pushback, you should really open up the conversation on why there's the pushback, because it's either lack of understanding. If they really think it's going to break something, then that's a risk, because attackers will do the same thing, right? They're going to look for things when they get in, and that's all it takes to bring you down. You're pretty fragile, right? So that's worth having that conversation. But being there's what different ways to be proactive, I guess, is what I'm getting at. And sometimes learning your environment and using, you know, tools to do so helps.
Yeah, I'll never stop in my career echoing in enough. Know your environment. That's such a strong requirement, really. Know your environment. All right. Jumping into the next one for this week. So I have a article from Unit 42. It's titled "Cyber Criminals Abuse Open Source Tools to Target Africa's Financial Sector." So this is a relatively short one, but I did think it was interesting. It's definitely some cool talking points. Unit 42 researchers have been monitoring a series of attacks targeting financial organizations across Africa. They assess that the threat actor is almost certainly gaining initial access to those institutions with the purpose of selling it to others on the dark web. Since at least July of 2023, a cluster of activity that Unit 42 tracks is CL-CRI-1014. Has continued to target this sector. The attackers employ a consistent playbook using a combination of open source and publicly available tools to establish their attack framework. They also create tunnels for network communication and perform remote admin activities. A couple that I thought were interesting, borderline scary. So some of the tools and techniques that were used, so they leveraged the POSH C2 tool set for the C2 framework that has tunneling and proxy support. They also use a tool called Chisel, which is used to create more covert network tunnels. And then from a remote administration side, they use a couple open source tools. One was Classroom Spy and the other one was Mesh Central Agent. So for remote administration, those tools were leveraged. One in particular, the Classroom Spy one, actually does a lot of kind of nasty things. So it does, you know, key logging, live screen monitoring, easily controls your mouse and keyboard, does audio recording, can access your system's camera and a lot more. So it's a pretty nasty one. They would use this one, I thought was interesting too, definitely worth talking about. They would leverage these tools, but they would do some obfuscation and they would sign them with stolen digital signatures. So they would sign these tools that they're deploying with things like Microsoft Corporation or security tools that might be there. Like one of the examples was Palo Alto Network signature, VMware, things like that. And then they would masquerade further as legitimate software by creating icons of the stolen signature company to kind of stack on that obfuscation. So, you know, there's some levels of persistence and evasion being leveraged here. We definitely talked about POSH C2. There's plenty out there to think about or consider. As far as that tool's concerned, different custom Windows services were deployed. This is one we talked about in previous weeks where you have these .lnk shortcuts that find their way into your startup folder. Scheduled tasks that were named after either the masqueraded tool signatures or even security tools of the environment. Some instances it might be highly targeted victims where they understood their environment a little more. But one example they gave is, you know, a scheduled task that's named Palo Alto's Cortex services, and that was actually malicious. And then you'd have credential theft, harvested credentials to configure proxy enable POSH C2 communications. So they would leverage these things in tandem. And then when we talk about kind of what we're looking at here, there's some strategic context involved. So Africa-wide targeting. So it affects banks, financial organizations amidst a rapidly growing fintech adoption in Africa. So it's kind of running a parallel with some of the advancements that the continent is making in those areas. And then kind of a broader trend too, you look at it part of an expanding focus on African targets due to digital growth and cybersecurity resource gaps. So they're bringing up their systems, but that cybersecurity consideration is behind their pace of growth, definitely leading to a lot of open doors. But when we kind of come through the rest of this, there's a couple of bullet points I had, Scott, that are things to consider hunting for. So the execution of open source C2 tools. So POSH C2 and Chisel both have pretty well written documentation about how these two things function. So understanding how to track for those or look for signatures. The LNK file drops in startup. These are things that we've talked about before, but it's an easy low hanging fruit one. Also, something that I don't know that it's necessarily easy to do per se, but looking at scheduled tasks created that are masquerading with that security sounding name. So looking, even if they're replicating your tools, I think it's worth potentially looking into when and how these are created. And I bet you could probably put some parameters around that to identify some anomalous type stuff if it were to happen.
And that's a good one, I think, when you look across your environment, because if it is legit and you run that in your environment, you would expect that to exist on multiple systems. And if it doesn't, it's questionable.
Yeah, very much so. But yeah, those are kind of like the couple things that really stood out to me is, you know, really that the masquerading techniques using that, the, you know, signing that open source tooling as these other things. I also found that one remote management tool a little bit more than just a remote management tool. I think the points where we're talking about the continent as itself were definitely something worth mentioning. You know, we've talked many times about this rapid pace of development, you know, when you're thinking cloud AI in general, but there's, you know, not every country is at the same level as another country or another area, or not every organization is at the same level as another organization. So keeping in mind your pace of growth and the technology you're leveraging relative to how you're securing it, it seems like a simple thing to say, but I think this is just a really good point to echo that argument that you really do want to consider these things because you are creating a lot of open doors if you're not, right? But I'll take a breath, see what you thought of this one.
Yeah, I mean, like some of the behaviors, you know, with PS Exec being leveraged for one, because knowing how PS Exec is utilized in your environment, some administrators really don't use it, except for when they run into a situation where they need such high level of access and it can help them get system access very easily to fix a problem. It's usually not baked into how they manage an environment. So it's always good to just know where, when that's being utilized. And you got, you know, it kicking out PowerShell and command prompt, you know, not too uncommon, but then you have, since PowerShell runs a PowerShell script, it kicks off PowerShell again. So you have like that script interpreter process chaining I've talked about before. The service thing is a good thing to pay attention to. But the other thing is the one thing I like about open source tooling, especially, is, you know, it's easy to get your hands on. It's something you can learn from when you play with and try to utilize and get running, because some of them doesn't like work right out of the box like you want it to. Like you have to figure out how to either compile something or tweak it so that it'll actually, you know, work properly. But you should have a system where you can just run these things, right? It's not gonna, you know, if you're running it yourself, it's not really the end of the world. But just know out of the gate that the tool sets I have automatically detect this. But you can take that even a step further and you can sit there and say, okay, what is it that it's detecting on, right? Sometimes the signatures or alerts will tell you, like you can easily tie it that it's matching a hash or it's matching, it'll look like a type of behavior or something like that, which is good to know, because then you know how maybe someone could try to leverage this and still not get automatically detected. But, you know, if you want to kind of level up your skills or you have some people on your team that maybe know how to tweak something, so maybe they can tweak the open source tool because the code's exposed. That if you're guessing how the detection is detecting it and you make some tweaks to see if you can change that from a tool perspective, just minor changes. I mean, just a minor change will at least change the hash, right? But that's another way where you can kind of do some testing and validation against your tools to know how much you need to look for other ways to potentially detect or hunt if you know the tool is doing a really good job based on some, maybe the core functionality of the tool is actually picking up on it from a behavior. You got really good coverage there. And you don't really know that other than saying, well, it alerted right out of the gate. You're like, well, for now, right? You want to make sure that conversation is more high confidence. And that's a good way to validate that is you have that environment or time to test like that. So yeah, there's the other pieces really to add there for me.
Yeah, I don't have anything else to go on that one. So we'll kick it over to you for the last one of the day, Scott.
But this one, it was just a blog from Securi, right? And it was called Stealthy WordPress Malware Drops Windows Trojan via PHP Backdoor. You know, a lot of times, well, we don't really talk about it that much. You know, it's interesting though, because I would say older people or people of the later generation seem to think of attacks happening this way, where if you just visit that bad website, you're going to get compromised, kind of thing. And the newer security professional is like, well, there's more to it than that, you know, and there's got all these things kind of have to line up for that to work. But interestingly enough, this is a way where it is kind of like that drive-by approach. But essentially, the article is called Stealthy WordPress Malware Drops Windows Trojan via PHP Backdoor. WordPress sites, especially if people aren't updating them for vulnerabilities, they're a type of content delivery, or I wouldn't say content delivery, what's the word I'm looking for? How you manage websites, backends, frameworks for websites that people use. And so attackers are constantly crawling for maybe ones that have been updated or aren't configured well, and they basically compromise those for a number of reasons. And in this case, you know, they're dropping PHP that when you then visit the site, it'll do a couple different things. One of the things it does is it actually keeps track of who's visited the site and tries to profile your browser and yourself and your system, so that it doesn't try to basically hit you more than once. But once it identifies you as a potential, I guess, victim, it will build a custom bat file for you, like a code on the fly. And that might be not necessarily because it's like super custom, but more so it's harder for defense tools to detect things being built on the fly than it is for them to just be handed something. So it ends up creating a bat that's an update.bat. And in that case, that will go fetch a zip that has an exe that will then basically run it, and it runs the malicious file. Obviously, it's using a lot of the app data directory, the environment variable for where it's going to drop certain things. But the other thing is interesting is the payload is downloaded via PowerShell. So that's what's being called. And it's doing a simple invoke web request. Then to the URI, whatever, you know, the destination is, and then the out file name. And they do a couple things here. One, they put carrots, which are the little arrow symbols above the six on the keyboard, because that's an ignored character in PowerShell. But by putting it, you know, within the arguments or commands, it makes it harder for detections that are built for looking for matching strings to find them, because it breaks it up enough. So it's kind of an obfuscation type technique, but more targeting detections, because I mean, it's still very human readable. So that gets extracted and built and then gets executed from a persistence perspective. Very common thing. It's not very sophisticated malware as far as all the different things they're considering, but they do use the registry run key to basically kick that off. And then it does try to delete some of the forensic traces, some of the files, in order to get everything delivered. It'll you know, basically target some of that. So pretty easy technique as far as how they, you know, were able to take advantage of, hey, you go to just a WordPress site that's poorly managed. And that's kind of what they're taking advantage of, to get this back door to these systems. And so, you know, just one of those things to kind of be aware. The biggest thing is they still break the attack up into multiple pieces. And that's like really key, because obviously that's the sidestep, easy detection. But because they break it up, it offers a lot of opportunities to look for different types of behaviors to perform different things. So looking for the way files are being pulled in with the PowerShell downloading, the way, if you look at the command structure with some of the obfuscation pieces of that. And sometimes where certain files are being written, and then possibly deleted, like, you know, since this is machine speed, I assume this happens pretty quick, but if you are able to see, hey, an executable gets written and then deleted, that sometimes is suspicious. Or if a bat file or things like that, something that's used to be executed is short lived, might be worth looking into or looking at the system for anything else. But those are just really simple, right? Attack that, you know, happens, and how to be aware of these things, and knowing that there's really easy capabilities to identify the behavior, even though it's really hard to sit there. You're not going to sit there and try to block every WordPress site or you do any of that discovery yourself or where someone might go. But you know, how to handle these types of attacks from a, you know, mechanism approach is, I think, a really easy way to manage them. So. Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of where my head's at on this one. What do you think?
Yeah, it wasn't anything necessarily overwhelmingly novel. I think I love, as a threat hunter and as a cybersecurity professional, I do love, even though we talk about them and echo them, I do love seeing some of the routine things, right? I love seeing the framework stuff, the typical invoke web request from a PowerShell command, or the establishing persistence in the registry run key, right? These things are, they make me feel confident that I can defend and I can detect these things with relative ease. Another thing that I thought was interesting that I caught at the back end of this article was some of the bullet points that they put out for, you know, what to consider for, you know, your end user side. And they talked about the, you know, not disabling UAC on Windows user access control, as it provides a crucial security prompt. I was reading that, Scott, and I was kind of like, do you think that would have stopped anything necessarily? I don't know. My brain got stuck on that bullet point because I know we've crossed conversations many different times about many different things relative to UAC. I don't know. I was curious what you thought of that statement that was made there.
It really depends on, so part of me, let me go back and look at some of the directories where they might be dropping some things. No, I mean, dropping things in app data. I'm trying to think if there's anything that would prompt for administrative access to. No, they're adding that you're using the current user, not the local user hive for registry stuff. So, you know, that really shouldn't prompt. So I think it's more of like
a general
practice. Yeah. But for this attack, it doesn't seem like it would really interfere with much, if anything.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I was seeing too. Cause my brain was like, I don't know, but you know, let's see what Scott thinks. But yeah.
Yeah, cool. So I think that kind of closes out the topics we were going to touch on, but some quick announcements just so you're aware of upcoming things that might be of interest. We are doing our live Out of the Woods podcast July 10th from 12 to 1:30 Eastern Standard Time. And that's going to be the intersection of AI and threat hunting. What problems emerge? What problems get solved? Hopefully we'll be able to cover down on that well. We also have an Intel-driven threat hunting workshop, which is going to be analyzing malware behaviors. That's July 31st. It's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. It is a full workshop where you get to kind of see how things are done, have potential data to work with and do alongside. So that'll be a good experience for some. So with that, I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast this week. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of June 30th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting.